Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Around the end of July, the back-to-school sale circulars started cramming the newspaper and my mailbox. My favorite was from an electronics retailer chain. The back-to-school essentials they offered included a range of television sets, just what every student needs to succeed, plus the latest expensive smartphones, so the student doesn't have to put up with last year's expensive smartphone, and so he can check out his Facebook friends whenever he starts to find history class a little dull. Back-to-school essentials. I love the word essentials. It always designates some largely unnecessary accessory. Companies marketing to women especially love the term. Handbag essentials, jewelry essentials, kitchen essentials. Today we'll be taking a close look at all this hardcore selling and marketing of consumer goods. We'll hear part of a documentary film by Gene Brokoff called Shop Till You Drop. First, though, I want to talk about a time when there was a real citizens' rebellion. I almost said consumer rebellion. A real citizens' rebellion against commercialism and the American consumer culture. This was the 1970s. And if the rebels were a minority, they were legion enough to thoroughly spook the establishment. But let's start in the present. A couple of bumper stickers have been popular for maybe a quarter century. You still see them on minivans and SUVs at the mall. Like much else in our culture, these bumper stickers are gender-specific. The female one reads, "Shop till you drop." The male one reads, "He who dies with the most toys wins." You've seen them. I suspect these shoppers imagine themselves bold iconoclasts, revolutionary hedonists like the Marquis de Sade. Instead, of course, they are merely demonstrating how thoroughly they've been brainwashed by the powerful forces of commerce, advertising, and marketing, and by the corporate-controlled mass media. These powerful forces have been working full steam to produce consumers like this since at least 1918. 90-some years. Why? Because 20th century corporations and their factories got more and more efficient and began producing more and more consumer goods at cheaper and cheaper prices. Soon they were producing far more goods than Americans needed. They'd have to sell all that stuff or they'd go bankrupt. Markets abroad couldn't begin to absorb their output. In various ways, the capitalists would have to overcome the traditional Yankee value of thrift, replacing it with buy more. And so modern marketing and the advertising industry were created. If a citizen already owned a perfectly serviceable item, a sofa, pair of shoes, toaster, car, cell phone, whatever, do your best to make him dissatisfied with it and purchase a new, trendier one. Or persuade her that no woman could possibly get through a year owning as few as 15 pairs of shoes. In the 1970s, there was a small but influential movement within popular culture. It was called the counterculture. It was far from pure or perfect, but it was a refreshing alternative to competitive, commercialized everything. This movement drove the Chamber of Commerce nuts. It rejected the U.S.'s imperial wars abroad. It rejected rampant, mindless consumerism. It advocated peace, love, freedom, and a simpler lifestyle. And the sexual promiscuity was a joy to behold. We won't go there today. A popular book of the period made a real impression on me. Its title was Living Poor with Style. Can you imagine a title like that being published today? I can't. Back then, of course, living on a very low budget was often a lifestyle choice, not a necessity. One chapter of Living Poor with Style really struck home with me. It said that the average kitchen contains maybe 15 really crappy cutting knives. For less to the cost of them, you could buy one or two really fine knives that would work beautifully, take care of all your cutting needs, and last for a generation or two. And here's what a good knife is like. I checked my kitchen drawers. Spot on. Soon afterwards, my wife and I combed downtown Pittsburgh. We finally found and bought a beautiful 6-inch Sabatier carbon steel chef's knife and gave most of our old knives to Goodwill. I used that chef's knife primarily for the next 25 years until my lousy sharpening technique had turned the blade's curve into a sine wave. Then I bought another very similar one, plus one for my son as a college graduation present. This is the opposite of shop until you drop, the opposite of trying to buy the most toys before you die. Don't expect to find this attitude encouraged by your neighbors or colleagues, let alone by the corporate-controlled mass media. I don't claim to be even close to purity, by the way. For example, somehow I seem to own more sweaters than any sane man would ever need. I'm not sure how this happened. Eternal vigilance is the price of a sane lifestyle. Now let's hear more on rampant consumerism and its disastrous effects on the people. The film Shop Till You Drop is sprawling and loosely organized, but it has many worthwhile things to say. We'll hear just part of it. It was adapted to radio by Robin Upton, producer of the show Unwelcome Guests. If you want to hear more, you'll find his adaptation available free on his website. It's part of episode 554 of his show. www.unwelcomeguests.net/554. Here's Gene Brokoff's Shop Till You Drop, starting with a different view of the 1970s.
In the 70s, you start to see things changing. A couple of big changes. One is the number of women going into the workforce, working for pay, increases, particularly among married women, married with children. They shift out of that more egalitarian neighborhood context into corporations, which are very hierarchical, and so they're exposed to people of higher economic levels, their boss, their boss's boss, and so forth. And then the other key thing is that instead of a situation in which people all up and down the economic distribution are pretty much just looking to others who are like them, more and more people start to gaze toward the top, the so-called affluent lifestyle. Now, that happens for a couple of reasons. One is that those people are becoming very conspicuous in the way they're consuming. They're getting into the newspapers and the magazines. Some of the most famous examples of this start in the 1980s, Dallas and Dynasty. Soap operas, which had always overrepresented the wealthy, come into prime time and are seen by many, many more people. This is the era where you have the show, The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which eventually, you know, morphs into MTV's Cribs and then Home and Garden TV. And as people watch more and more media, they're no longer seeing what's happening with their neighbors because they're increasingly don't even know their neighbors. Or new kinds of houses got built where people drive right into the house when they come home and they don't have to go outside. So the decline of social interaction at the neighborhood level becomes very important. And it's a process like what Devlin was talking about in the 1890s. Really, really conspicuous consumption.
Enter the age of modern advertising. Consumption may have been conspicuous, but appeals to our consumer desires would become even more so, giving rise to a glistening new world of images and messages and brands. A world of surface appeals targeted at deep human needs by a new class of experts charged with awakening our inner urge to shop.
Rob Gourney, Executive Director, Ashley Montague Institute.
For those of us who have enough, We are no longer stimulated by our cravings and our scarcity to consume more. So now, in order to make us consume more, we are subjected to a lot of propaganda.
Oh my God, everything is advertising.
We're being run by our subconscious drives. And as long as we're being run by our subconscious drives, then those who are conscious of those drives can manipulate them and control them. And so then it's really just lining up the barnyard animals, and farmers find that if you play soothing music, the cows give better milk. So you get mall music everywhere.
We have opened our doors to the devil.
Chris Jordan, graphic artist.
The machine of advertising and marketing that has just become phenomenally sophisticated over the last 40 or 50 years is in very large part running the whole consumer culture.
On every billboard, radio, and television, on every newspaper and magazine.
And it's frightening because they've gotten so good at reaching in and finding what motivates, you know, the macho man, or the even beautiful woman but who wants to be more beautiful, or the uncomfortable teenager. Like, they know how to go straight to our fears.
Ladies and gentlemen, this commercial is going to use subliminal advertising.
In a very strange way, I think our society is being subjected to a kind of mind control.
That means you will never see or hear the name of the product.
It's very much to me like the movie The Matrix.
Sales, they've got to go up.
We have to step back out of the Matrix and learn how to make choices for ourselves.
You're powerless.
I'll show you how powerless I am. My brain burns with it.
They've switched. It used to be, you know, if you buy this, then you'll be popular. And now it's buy this and you will be happy.
Make your holiday wishes come true.
They're very, very clever. And no, I think it's a, particularly towards kids.
Duane Elgin, author of Voluntary Simplicity.
I think it's enormously unfair to take some of the best trained minds in cognitive psychology, to take some of the best trained technicians working with computer animations and graphics, put those together into short segments of 30 seconds or so that tell people, well, here's who you are and here's what's important.
Let's not forget the young people.
In my last book, Born to Buy, I did a survey of kids. This is a group, the market is called tweens. They're marketed to very, very intensely. What my survey found is that involvement in consumer culture undermines kids' well-being in a variety of ways, that the kids who are less exposed, those kids are better off. They're healthier. They have a better sense of self.
Give those kids something for their busy little minds, I always say.
I used a statistical model that allows us to ask the question, is it poor parenting that leads to consumer involvement? But what's interesting today is that the good parents and the bad parents have super consumer involved kids.
We're spending 20 times as much to target kids with advertising today as we were in 1980. This is paying off. And the tactics, which include trying to make parents look like idiots and fuddy-duddies, this sort of stuff to promote aggressive and rude behavior because it's cool and will sell a product. I've heard marketers say antisocial
behavior in pursuit of a product is a good thing.
Sweden doesn't allow advertising to kids under 12. Neither does the province of Quebec, and neither should we.
Carol Holst, director of Post Consumers.
If your children are growing up in a culture in which what everybody is doing is involving themselves in consumer culture, it's very difficult to isolate them from that.
I think Madison Avenue has an enormous amount of power in our lives. It's been said that to control a society, you don't need to control its courts, you don't need to control its armies. All you need to do is control its stories. And it's television and Madison Avenue that's telling us most of the stories, most of the time, to most of the people.
It's interesting. I think a number of folks, myself included, get to a certain point where it's really invisible. And I think, in a sense, because it's so all-pervasive, the advertisers have created that scenario themselves. You know, they've bombarded us with messages to the point where we just don't listen anymore and honestly don't care. So I don't really have the anger around it, but I know some people do.
It's subliminal, right?
Subliminal.
You're like walking around and there's all sorts of posters and banners and stuff that you don't even recognize, you don't even see.
We just bought a car, and I believe that the advertising was a big part of that.
I've got some big news.
The average person sees about 25,000 commercials on television a year, and every commercial is not simply a pitch for a product, it's a pitch for a set of values, an attitude towards life.
If you realize that the human being is hardwired to respond emotionally to stories, you can now understand why applying stories to things is so important. So if you have a widget that comes out of a widget machine, and here's another widget from another widget machine, if I can tell you a story about this one that separates this one from that one, I can actually get you to feel differently. And feeling is what we're after. Very often luxury objects are objects that are only separated because of the way they're able to make us feel, oh, now I've got it. Got what? Got overpriced water? Got an overpriced car? You put the logic machine on top of it, it makes no sense. But you put the emotional machine next to it, you can see what's happening.
Human beings are very unusual in that they have a large enough brain and a capacity to be able to see beyond the immediate instinctual striving, which is what drives most animals. The part of the brain that grew is our frontal lobes, which are the intelligent, rational part of the brain. So on the one hand, we're instinctually driven, but on the other side, we have this incredible intelligence, which allows us to either harness the instinctual stuff or to be harnessed by it. From a neuroscience standpoint, this is predicated upon the very well worked out and understood process by which the brain pays attention to the environment, and it's called the reward system, and it's driven by a set of chemistries which are called the dopamine chemistries. There are many ways in which this reward system can be hijacked. The most obvious are things like cocaine, amphetamines, caffeine.
I like coffee.
But those systems, once they are hijacked, they essentially take over all the rational part of thinking. I mean, they're very valuable in keeping us safe and telling us what's good and bad in the world, but the danger is that they get caught up in a reward cycle which is meaningless. I like ice cream. I like potato chips. But I know that if I were to eat ice cream and potato chips all day long, I would probably turn out to be weighing 250 pounds, which probably would not be good for me. It used to be restricted because there was no ice cream and there were no potato chips. But now, in our affluent society, we have all these things. We have to consciously say to ourselves, how much of this do I need? You know, more of this is not enough. You need something beyond ice cream and chips. So it's complicated, but it's not difficult to understand. It's a balance between rational behavior and instinctual behavior. The instinctual behavior is what drives the reward system, and the rational behavior is what makes you human.
Juliet Shaw, professor of sociology from Boston College.
Let's just think about the context in which we're living.
We are continuously looking for new things.
So that the consumer marketplace never stays still. And in fact, things are accelerating.
So everybody wants a new cell phone, even though the old one's working perfectly. You want one with a flip-up top, or the one that's silver or red, or, you know, has more buttons on it.
Everything has to be stainless steel. I can't live without anything stainless steel. And I got all kinds of play toys.
I like to walk through big super centers just as like a test of will, you know. I'll go down and I'll just be like, oh, that looks delicious. No.
Coffee maker, espresso machine. And I got a Bentley and a latte and it's red. My one thing is I like Coach purses. Perfume. Can't have sexy clothes without perfume. Jewelry.
Okay, that would be fine in some ways if it were sustainable in a financial sense or in an ecological sense. because the system is always moving. Your identity with any one set of products is always changing. But the basic rationale behind wanting the stuff is very fundamentally rooted in deep social dynamics around inequality, competition, social esteem, and so forth. Because our system says that you gain esteem through what you have and how you show it. Consumption is about social communication and social connection. The problem isn't that consumption is social. That's a good thing. The problem is that we are socially communicating, connecting in very perverse and dysfunctional ways.
The rise of consumer society has long raised serious concerns about declines in democratic participation and citizenship. Whatever the virtues of consumption, they have not always sat well with the basic demand in democratic societies for people who know what's going on in the world and aren't afraid to participate in it.
John Dewey, on his 90th birthday, said, "Democracy is born in conversation, and it's talking to each other about it and getting a chance to think. If we have this lifestyle that has no time, that's filled up with advertising all the time, or working long hours, or driving in your car, you know, we have to run around to do things. We can't walk, we can't ride a bike."
The barriers that have now allowed us to essentially work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they've been removed. You know, the time is no longer an issue, space is no longer an issue, distance is no longer an issue. We can just work all the time. What you find is that there's a rising level of anxiety in the country because everybody's continuously competing, worrying that somehow somebody's going to get ahead of them.
With that shift to that vertical emulation process where now everybody wants to live like the upper middle class and the wealthy, that's happening at a time when people's actual ability to do that financially is eroding. As wages have stagnated, as families have to add another earner to the labor force in order just to keep up, what do? Well, they borrow more, they work more hours, they run down their savings.
All that makes people very anxious because they're constantly on their toes. The human body wasn't designed for that. The human body was designed for acute emergencies. But when the acute emergency is continuous, when the alarm bells are ringing all the time, it never relaxes. And the results of that are people get all sorts of stress diseases. Anxiety is just the beginning. Depression, they get depression because they feel they can't cope. They get other somatic diseases like hypertension, cardiovascular disease. So one of the most obvious results of this fast-paced world is that we tend to reduce the time we spend in social interaction around very important functions, such as eating, for example. And we spend much less time now eating around a table than we do driving around in a car together.
Hey, Mom! Look, I don't want to hear another word out of you. Bobby, Billy, Betty, what the hell's the kid's name?
John DeGraff, National Coordinator of Take Back Your Time.
In our families, even our pets are affected by this. You know, not too long ago, there was a story in a Marin County newspaper that said that the fastest growing business in Marin was professional dog walkers. Even a dog's life isn't what it used to be.
I think Lily Tomlin described it well when she said the problem with the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat. And people are feeling themselves as a part of that busyness, and they want to declutter their lives. They want to simplify their lives so they have more time for that which really matters.
Cecile Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful.
You know, I ask people when I go and speak to people at workplaces, and I say, you know, do you feel some hope? Can you do something about your lack of time? And they say, no. And I always think, how can this have happened? The most powerful country in the world, and its people feel powerless to change?
Peter Wybrow, author of American Mania.
So the affluence drives us into sickness because we can't figure out what to do with it. We haven't spent enough time thinking about it. We've spent a lot of time thinking about how to survive when there isn't much around to eat or when it's dangerous, etc., etc., but we haven't spent any time thinking about what to do with affluence.
How did we get into this problem that we're faced with now, where life is becoming more and more complicated and where we are urgently in need of greater simplicity.
Well, that sounds like a leading question, but let's have it.
The first cell and all of the species in between that first cell and ourselves were guided by a basic principle, which you could call the basic law of life, cooperation.
Where's all this competition we've heard so much about?
Competition was always a part of that evolution, but everywhere and always, competition was subordinate until relatively recently. 3 million years ago, our earliest human relatives began to evolve on this planet. They survived mainly by taking care of each other. And they took care of each other not because they were saints, but because they were each other's only social security. Whether or not we admit this today, we survive as a species mainly because we are still the virtuoso caretakers of one another.
And maybe that's the biggest way you feel alive, is when you help each other. And you don't do that in a consumer society.
Julian Darling, Executive Director of Post Garvan Institute.
A lot of the root of our consumption and a lot of the root of many of our other problems, psychological problems and so forth, emotional problems which we see all around us, those can be found in our tendency towards individualism. Once you start thinking of yourself as an individual, an awful lot of the glue that keeps us together, makes us feel part of something, starts to dissolve. It's worth pointing out that large quantities of money and energy drive that dissolution quicker than almost anything else. Because what happens is it gives you the ability to separate yourself from others.
Whatever level of community we had from the 1940s and 50s has been destroyed. Television's been a big part of that.
The old social structures are falling away, but they're essential to human learning. They're the sort of immune system, the crucible of the next generation. And we're not spending any time thinking about how we replace them.
Once you're an individual, that stresses this idea of being separated kind of an entity. So that means you need a separate house, a separate car, separate cooking facilities, washing machine, dishwasher, fridge or fridges, bathing, cleaning, everything you can imagine.
We're a victim of our myth. That myth that the road to the good life is the goods life, that the good economy is the economy that always grows more and more and more and more and more and more.
From the movie Shop Till You Drop. As I said, it's sprawling, wide-ranging to a fault, but with many interesting things to say about our consumer culture. Thanks for listening to New World Notes, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non-carborundum, and see you later.